And good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight, I'm very blessed with having Bob Freeman online. And Bob, you have taught university English. You've been a freelance photographer. You've been the managing editor of a city magazine. You have a master's in fine arts and writing from the University of North Carolina, president and co-founder of the Dawning Company Publishing, where you publish pictorial histories, regional books, cookbooks, science fiction, fantasy, and metaphysics spirituality. Right now, you are the president and co-founder of Hampton Roads Publishing Company with Frank DeMarco, which you now publish in the genres of metaphysics, spirituality, fiction, children's books, health and wellness, and philosophy, new thought, including the world-famous Conversations with God series, books with Neil Donald Walsh, Lynn Grabhorn's Excuse Me, Your Life is Waiting, and The Messiah's Handbook by Richard Bach. So you have published over 1,000 titles in over 34 years in the business, pioneered publications and marketing, the first science fiction trade paperback, first line of graphic novels, had numerous national bestseller books on the national bestsellers list, including 5 on the New York Times list. So you have had quite a journey on its own. So welcome, Bob, for coming onto this show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Mm-hmm. So usually what happens is I like to start with people's journeys. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the extensive journey that you've had right now. Now, we are getting you on here tonight to actually talk about a children's book, which is called Milton's Secret, and you co-authored this with Eckhart Tolle, and I'm really excited to talk to you about that tonight, but let's start first with your journey and, you know, a little bit about Hampton Roads and, you know, how you got involved in that, but let's start with your journey.
Well, how early do you want to go?
You know, whatever really is part of the journey that got you to where you are now.
I started reading in probably metaphysics in the early 70s, I think, when I was in Atlanta and had some free time, excuse me, and also was doing some freelance photography at the time and almost went into the photography business. But I started reading the Seth material and the Edgar Cayce material, and I got fascinated with that kind of metaphysics and spirituality, kind of searching for meaning as a lot of young people do.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to work for a city magazine in Norfolk, Virginia, which is near where I grew up in Portsmouth. And we did a series of articles in the early 70s on what they used to call ESP in the Tidewater area, or the Hampton Roads area, which is Virginia Beach and Norfolk and Portsmouth and on the east coast of Virginia. And at the time, the Edgar Cayce Foundation was building a new library. And so we interviewed some people, and I met this woman who was a psychic, a kind of a trance psychic, and I just went along to take some pictures. I wasn't writing the story.
Okay.
And we met, and I, you know, she asked to do a reading for me, and I came back sometime later, and she did this reading, which kind of blew my mind at the time. And I was told that I'd be involved in international publishing and that sort of thing. And of course, I had no idea of that at the time. I was just a managing editor of a small town magazine, and had done some English teaching in the past, and that was my degree in English and then in writing. But I remembered that, and then a year or so later, the opportunity came to start a publishing company, which was focusing on pictorial histories.
Okay.
And I remembered that prediction, so it kind of made it easier and gave me some impetus to get started, and that's when we formed the Dawning Company in 1974. And, you know, we did mostly pictorial histories at the time and some regional books and cookbooks. But I managed to throw in a few metaphysical books, in the mix. And
nice.
Became interested in that area of publishing. And we actually sold that company in 85, and I started Hampton Roads in 89 for the primary purpose of just publishing those kinds of books. Spiritual books and metaphysical books and alternative medicine, health and healing, that sort of thing.
And why did that really inspire you? What was it about that, I mean, was that where your heart was?
Yes, it was. It was, I wanted to put out material which I felt would help enlighten people and teach them some things and, make the world a better place.
Now, I read somewhere that you had sort of an epiphany while you were at a Shirley MacLaine lecture. Was that before Hampton Roads?
Yes, that was 1987, actually. And I'm not sure I would call that an epiphany. I just happened to meet my future partner was at that event.
Wow.
We wound up meeting later and kind of comparing notes. We didn't meet there because there were 700 people in the room, but Shirley had, that was her first seminar after she'd done Out on a Limb, and she was, really helping to widen the market for those kinds of books almost single-handedly. She doubled the shelf space in most bookstores.
Yeah.
Because of the success of the Out on a Limb miniseries and book, and she was going around the country and being attacked on all of the talk shows, and she got a lot of exposure for her beliefs and writings at the time. But we didn't start Hampton Roads until 1989.
And was there any specific event or anything that kind of brought you into this area, or you just were always interested when you were younger?
Well, I think it was the reading part. Back in the 70s, I was devouring every book I could on the Seth material, that
yeah.
type of stuff, and a lot of people go through that process. I don't think it was any particular epiphany other than that reading that had said, I'd be involved in publishing. And I always thought about that and figured, well, maybe that's where I'm supposed to be. And kind of stayed there for, a lot of years. It's been 34 years now.
Yeah. And, this Hampton Roads is really well known to, if you want, books in this area, this is kind of the place to go. I mean, even your logo is for the evolving human spirit. I mean, you're really definitely, this is truly who you are.
Yes, I would say so. I've never looked back. as a famous saying is, something may be gaining on you, but I've always felt I was in the right place. I had never thought I'd be publishing a book, though. That was an interesting series of events that led to that. Even though I have a degree in writing, I never used it much.
Wow.
Once I got diverted into the publishing area. And then you have, get married and have kids and have to make a living and go off in that direction. My mother used to say, you can write on the side, you'll never make a living at it.
Oh. So how much of that was in you that you really wanted to do?
In terms of writing?
Yeah.
I never thought of myself as, having a career in writing. I wrote primarily poetry and some short stories, and I had
a
book of short stories that was actually my thesis as a master's degree thesis.
Nice.
But I didn't have the fire in the belly for it, get up in the morning and write every day. And I know many authors who do, and I really admire their perseverance and their, that fire in the belly that they have to keep on doing it no matter what. And I never had that for writing. I had it for publishing, but
nice.
It just didn't seem to be something that drove me. You know, I wasn't. I didn't feel like that was my major calling. But the way this book turned out, it was just an interesting series of coincidences. Although,
oh, I want to talk about that. but how big was getting in connection with Neil Donald Walsh in Conversations with God?
Well, I actually started Neil. You know, I published him out of the slush pile.
Uh-huh. Nice.
So it was, you know, I got there real early in 19. He sent me his Conversations with God, Book One, back in the fall of 1994.
Okay.
So I was the first one that published the book in May of 95, or at least we were, the company, Hampton Roads.
Right.
So it was easy to get involved with him because we
didn't. Well, we saw the movie, so.
We never knew, you know, how big it was going to get. I mean, that's something you never know, and it just kind of surprises you. But he wound up selling probably 5 million copies of that book, and it's now in like 37 languages and around the world. So,
right.
And he's also done another 20 or so books.
Wow.
So we never realized it was going to be that big. Of course, when we first published a printing of 5,000 copies in May of 1995.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, at that time, were you still a pretty small publishing house?
Well, yes, we were. We, you know, we had 10 employees, and we had just published the book a couple of months before we moved up from Norfolk to Charlottesville, Virginia, which is where we are now. And, you know, we wound up, I think we had about 10 or 12 employees at the time, and we were doing our own shipping out of our little building, that little 2,000 square foot building. And that book kind of spurred our growth. And
definitely. I mean, that
put us on the map.
Yeah, for sure.
And for getting other books out there, which is really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so as much as your background has been in writing, you never really pursued it until Milton's Secret. So tell us the story about how that came to be.
Well, it's pretty simple. It was just a series of, you know, what some people would call coincidences or synchronicity. I just happened to be sitting next to Constance Kello at an awards dinner at one of the book expos several years ago. We both had a book up for an award by the then NAPRL organization, which was the New Age Publishers and Retailers Association. And they gave awards every year, you know, for different books and categories. And we happened to be sitting next to each other, and, you know, we talked, and she was the publisher of Namaste Publishing out of Vancouver, which was basically her. It's an interesting story. You know, Eckhart had met her at, I guess, a class or something, and he just walked up to her and he said, "You're going to publish my book." And he had just written The Power of Now, and of course Constance had no knowledge of publishing whatsoever. She was, I think at the time, a housewife married to a tax attorney in Vancouver. But for some reason he knew she was the one, and she decided to give it a shot. She did it, put it out, and it, you know, got it in a few bookstores. She had no distribution, no sales reps, and it just kind of picked up by word of mouth in some of the stores. And about a year later, one of the Canadian distributors picked it up and put it out further, and it was a word of mouth phenomenon. And finally, they sold the book to New World Library in California, which put it out in another edition and wound up selling a couple million copies of it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he did A New Earth about almost 3 years ago, I think that came out. And they sold that to Penguin Putnam to get better distribution. And when I met Constance, I'd read The Power of Now, and I knew about Eckhart, but of course he hadn't published A New Earth yet. But I asked her if about a year later I had the idea to do a children's book, you know, putting his ideas that were in The Power of Now into a book that children could understand. And I sent her an email about that, and she wrote back immediately and said, yes, he'd love to do that. He's always wanted to do a book for children, but he doesn't know how to write one. So I said, well, why don't we co-publish it, and we'll get a writer, you know, and he can have his input and his approval, and he can do whatever he wants with it. And we signed that contract, and then I started to think, you know, if I get a children's book writer who's had any credits or has any, you know, reputation or anything like that, there could be some ego problems here. Because Eckhart's going to change that book in any way he wants. And, you know, there could be problems if you don't check your ego at the door on this situation. So I figured, you know, hey, I used to be a writer. I'll give it a shot. So I told her I'd write a story, and, you know, if they liked it, we can work with that, and if they didn't, you know, we'll get another writer, and they can write a story. We're going to get a book one way or the other.
Nice.
So I wrote the story, and they liked it, and they started to work with it. Both Constance and Eckhart kind of put their two cents into it, and we went back and forth for 6 or 8 months before it finally got, finalized. And but the spine of the story and the characters, you know, stayed the same, although Eckhart added some things. He put a cat in there, which I didn't put in. I'm not a cat person. I'm more of a dog person. But it was a brilliant move to put Snuggles the cat in there, because it really illustrated a very important point about living in the now, because animals all live in the now.
Sure. Definitely.
And that's how it came about. It was, it was done before Eckhart became Oprah Winfrey's favorite son. So, you know, she picked him, New Earth, as a book club selection, I think, last January.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been out 2 years before she picked it up. And, you know, all of a sudden it was the fastest selling book club selection she's ever had. And it was the fastest-selling book that Penguin Putnam ever had in their history.
Wow.
It was an amazing phenomenon. And he wasn't even on the show. I think she did 10 hour-and-a-half live webcast with him, where 2 million people went online to see that every Monday night for 10 straight weeks.
Yeah.
It's still archived, I think, on her site if anybody wants to listen to it. It's really wonderful.
It is.
But they were live broadcasts. And then, of course, it became a phenomenon. I think they've sold 10 million books since
wow.
January. Of the two of them, Power Now started to sell again, because The New Earth kind of picked that up and, gave that a whole new wave.
Mm-hmm.
So, that happened before our book came out, so... It certainly didn't hurt any.
No. No, I think that's going to help this little children's book a lot.
Some people would call that luck.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. But I like to call it skill.
Skill. There you go. Because you knew intuitively.
Well, that's certainly, you could make that argument. Consciously, I certainly didn't sit there at my desk and say, oh, Oprah's going to pick him up.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. We were never able to get Neil Donald Walsh on Oprah. We did interview him for about an hour and a half and filmed it, but it never made the show. Little snippets made the show. We knew she loved the book, but I guess our producer said, "What? Put a guy on there who talks to God? Are you crazy? They're in rubber rooms all over the country." So it was probably a difficult decision for her to make that leap, although Larry King put him on.
So you must know a lot about Tolle, his work, and the power of now to be able to have written a children's book, because it takes a lot. I mean, you're one having to really simplify it, and you're having to really understand and grasp the knowledge to be able to do this.
It's a fairly simple message. It's not really that complicated a message when you boil it down. I mean, what Eckhart is basically saying is that most people don't live in the moment. They live in the past. They recapitulate their past over and over, or they fear the future. Mm-hmm. And they continually live in the past or the future, and that the now, the present, is really the point of power. And it's also the place where happiness and joy reside. And when you live in the past and you keep funneling everything that's happening in the now through what's happened to you in your past, or what you've read, or what other people have told you, or anything that's impacted your beliefs and who you think you are, it takes away your joy, your peace. It robs you of it, because you're concerned about the past, you're worrying about the future, you're not enjoying the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty simple concept. And of course he went on in a New Earth to talk about how the ego works to do that, and how you can basically overcome it. But the power of now was really just a question and answer type book that he wrote about how to live in the now. And he came to that through an epiphany that he had, where he was very depressed, I think, and he was even contemplating suicide at the time. I think he told the story on the Oprah webcast, but he basically said, you know, I was thinking to myself, I can't live with myself any longer. And when he had that thought, something hit him, and he thought to himself, I, myself, there must be two of me. And he realized that maybe there was a level of consciousness that was above this stream of consciousness that was going through his head all the time, that goes through all of our heads. And you really can't stop that. But he realized that you could get a little bit higher level of awareness where you can kind of look down on that stream of thought and say, oh, I can see that. I can see that going by. And if you get to that level, then that stream of consciousness no longer controls you. You are aware that there's something a little bit beyond that you don't have to, access that all that stuff from your past and bring it up. You know, people often say, you're just like my mother, you know, that kind of thing. You know, that's accessing whatever happened to that person with their mother and layering on the person in the now, in the present, who you happen to be with. And it totally affects the relationship, because you're saying, you know, you're bringing all that stuff up, and you're putting it onto, bringing it into where the now is. And if you think about it, we all only live in the now. We live in the moment. The past doesn't exist any longer. What I said 10 minutes ago is gone, except it's been recorded, but it's gone. And, you know, what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes hasn't happened yet.
Right.
It's in the future. So where we are right at this moment, talking right now, is our now. And we're always in a series of nows. So Eckhart was brilliant in putting that into words in The Power of Now to show you how to live in the present and smell the flowers and walk in nature and just be aware of who you are in the moment. And that was his brilliance as a writer.
And so did that book have a huge impact on you when you read it? Obviously, I think you may have grasped some of these understandings prior to this, but was it kind of one of your, like an aha when you read it, that it allowed you to want to expand into a children's book? Like there
well,
was just
I
a part of
it. When I read it, I wasn't thinking of, you know, children's book. I was just, you know, there's a saying, there's nothing new under the sun.
Absolutely.
And I don't think there was much in there that was, you know, that new to me. I had read it in many places. But the way he wrote it, I mean, that's really what makes a book great. And that's what differentiates one book from another. I mean, Conversations with God is the same way, you know. It's mm-hmm. the way it was done, the way it was written and presented, that people could access it, understand it, and relate to it.
Right.
And I think The Power Now had that same quality to it. I mean, just the way it was so brilliantly written is where its power is. It's not so much that there's this new, there was new stuff for me, but there's going to be new stuff for a whole lot of people out there who have no idea, you know, what they're doing in living in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a total revelation to most of these people. The layers of consciousness that you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this higher dimension of consciousness, which Eckhart calls presence. Some people call it source or God, or, you know, there are a lot of different names for it. But the way he showed how you can access that, and, you know, to access the now, was absolutely brilliant. And that's what made the book so compelling and sold so well. It's mm-hmm. not that it's a totally new idea.
It's just the simplicity of the way yeah. he writes.
You know, one time somebody came up to Neil at a lecture, and they said, thank you for writing The Course in Miracles in English.
Yeah.
Well, you know, The Course in Miracles is written in English.
Yeah, of
but
course.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I do. Yeah, very much so.
So it's not, again, it's not something that everything is so totally new in that book, although it's new to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people who read Conversations with God aren't aware of the kind of God that Neil writes about and talks about, which is basically a non-judgmental, non-punishing God. And people have a hard time, you know, wrapping their minds around that. You know, how can God not punish people? How can God not judge people? But the entire Old Testament is based on that. And most of the religions on the planet are.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a new concept for a lot of people, and a lot of them didn't like it.
Yes. I know I've tried to give the book to a few people like that. It didn't go over well, but I didn't understand there. I mean, I did. I just...
Well, you know, to his credit, he doesn't try to change people's beliefs or whatever. He's not a proselytizer. He didn't go out and pound it over the... over your head, but he basically says, you know, here it is. If you want to, if it means anything, great. If it doesn't, I'm fine with that too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a wonderful way to be, you know. Otherwise, you're going to be dangerous if you try to force people to believe what you believe, whatever it happens to be.
Then you're just creating another dogma that we already have enough of.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So what is the relationship of Milton's secret to The Power of Now?
Well, the story is a very simple story about an happy 8-year-old kid who's going to school and has two wonderful parents and a cat. And And he's just happy in his life, and he goes to school one day, and this big bully pushes him down and threatens him, and it just completely changes his outlook on life. He goes home, and he's fearful, and he's remembering that, and he's thinking, you know, why me? Why me? Why did he do that to me? And he can't enjoy being a kid in the present any longer because he keeps dreaming about it and remembering it and not eating. And then he starts to fear the future and, you know, going to school and having it happen again. And he keeps looking, you know, cracking open doors to make sure the guy's not around. And so it completely shifts his life. And his grandfather happens to be visiting in the home. Notices, of course, that he's not the same Milton that he was, and tries to draw it out of him, you know, what happened, and you know, that's how the story, you know, evolves, so that he tries to get him back into the now where he was before. He was happy, and, you know, not that he didn't have any problems, but this kind of, you know, this bullying thing just shifted his whole perspective of life and robbed him of his joy. So the idea was how to get that back.
Mm-hmm. And there were two areas that was brought in, which was the outside of now and the inside of now, which I think is brilliant. But why did you pick bullying as your central theme?
You know, it's just one of those creative things that just pops in your head, you know. I think everybody's been bullied in their life. You know, I was when I was a kid. And, you know, just you kind of look back and look for the story. And, you know, it's like Neil says, sometimes he's in the shower and the story just comes, you know, he wrote Little Soul in the Sun while he was taking a shower one day. You know, it just came to him.
Right.
And that's how you access, I guess, some sort of level of creativity. You know, even Plato wrote about it, and I think every artist, you know, of any kind, will acknowledge that they get their stuff from somewhere that's not necessarily in their head. You know, it just comes to them, music or painting or anything that's creative.
Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is a theme right now with, you know, with kids, with especially gangs and groups, where, you know, bullying has become, you know, somewhat of a kind of global, I wouldn't want to say issue, but certainly there seems to be more and more of it. And I think, you know, a lot of times it's these kids that aren't being heard and aren't being understood and, you know, needing an outlet that, you know, they're not seeming to be, I guess, understood in any way or heard in any way. And you know, the school system isn't really meeting a lot of the kids' needs and, you know, maybe not at Milton's age, but certainly as they get older. And I think, you know, it is a theme that seems to be quite prevalent right now. And I think the kids need, you know, to know what they can do to sort of help them understand and help them not have to get into that type of bullying. I mean, certainly Milton figures it out at the end, which I think is, you know, quite brilliant about how unhappy, you know, the bully was, like how unhappy this character was that did bully him.
Right, and that's where we're going to go with the continuation of the story. Get more into who Carter is and why he is the way he is, and because obviously his bullying came from somewhere. He learned it from somewhere.
Right. So there is going to be a continuation. There's going to be a sequel, is there?
Well, hopefully. We're not absolutely sure, but we just signed an option for a live action film.
Nice.
Which is supposed to be out next fall from Peace Arch Entertainment out of Los Angeles. and they want to do a series of DVDs. So they're going to want some more material, and they're going to have some of their own writers obviously do the scripts. But so we're not sure where it's going to go, but we're hoping that we'll have a series of books that kind of follow Milton along and keep teaching the spiritual lessons that Eckhart espouses.
Wow. That's great, because I think it'll be very timely, and a lot of kids will relate and understand. And it's also a great way to get, a really simple message out to these kids about how to be in the now. And I love, the subtitle of the book is An Adventure of Discovery Through Then, When, and the Power of Now. And certainly, we were talking about it, but the then and when, what happened then and what will happen when. And so we're always looking at, the event or something from the past and worrying about what's going to happen in the future.
Right. With the ego, if you read A New Earth, Eckhart gets more into, why this kind of thing happens and how the ego works. And it's another brilliant book. And but the ego basically creates that. It creates separation. Its job is to create separation, to protect what it considers you, you in the physical body, and you as a human being. The ego's job is to protect, its host, in a way. It loves conflict because it can keep you separate. It can control your feelings and your emotions. And the only way you can overcome that is to notice it, to become aware of it, to get to that little higher level where, the other day a friend of mine was saying that his girlfriend was saying to him, she said something to him like, "My mother did that to me, and you're doing the same thing." Now that brings the past up and creates conflict, because it's going to get an angry reaction, and it keeps dragging the past up, overlaying it onto the present. And the ego loves that. But you can also choose to observe it. You don't have to react to it. You can say, "Oh, I know where that's coming from. I'm not your mother. This is me." Instead of reacting in an ego way, you can observe it. You don't have that knee-jerk reaction. You let your higher consciousness say, "Oh, I see I'm letting this past judgment affect my present. I can choose not to do that." You don't have to accept the judgment. You can just say, "I'm going to stay right where I am. I don't accept that. I'm not like your mother." So it shifts the whole dynamic, not only of the relationship, but, the way the person looks at the present, or is in the present, or is in the moment.
And I mean, the grandfather was quite brilliant when he brought up that, the past and the future, or the then and the when, they're all in our head. They're the things that we keep in our head. They have nothing to do with our actual experience right now.
Exactly. That's all in your head. he took Milton to the playground at the school where it happened, and he said, "Now, where did this happen?" And he showed him. He said, "Is it happening now?" And Milton said, "No." And he taught him that little lesson that, that happened a while ago. It's gone. You can still remember it. It's all in your head. But the way you remember it, you have control over that. And it's not to say that, we also point out in there that you need to tell your parents and you need to tell your teacher. It's like if someone really reads the book and they're being bullied, they need to also take these other steps. And there's lots of things that that you can do. You can learn Taekwondo, you know. But it's not to say that you should, you know, only you should ignore that there really is a threat, you know, when it happens. But you don't have to fear it any longer if you can control the reaction. You know, if it happens, it happens. Then it happens in the present, and then you deal with it in the present.
Yeah.
But it doesn't ruin your joy, you know, to sit there and change your life by fearing it. So, you know, you fear to go. A lot of people fear to go outside because they're afraid of what might happen to them.
That's right. So, Snuggles the Cat brought up the same mirror that Milton was going through, where he got bullied. And then, I guess, through that, as all animals live in the now, was able to show him a clear example of the fact that it could live in the now.
Yeah, the cat was an important example because it gets kind of mauled by this dog, this untrained dog across the street, and, you know, gets hurt. And, of course, he has to fix it up, you know, and treat it and whatever. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, the cat's laying on his lap, purring like nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Milton realizes that. And, of course, the grandfather points out, well, you know, cats live in the now. They're not remembering what happened 10 minutes ago. I mean, it's in their memory. The next time that cat sees that dog, you know, it's going to make a wide berth, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like you don't forget the past, otherwise you might put your hand on a hot stove and burn yourself, you know. You have to remember. The memory's there. It's the way you deal with the memory that's important. It keeps you in the now, and you have to access that little bit, that higher level, to be able to do that, or otherwise you're so caught up in that you don't realize the difference between the thought of the past and the actual past.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, showing just how fearful Milton was, that he was so caught up that night in his own mind and his own fears and his own pain that he didn't even hear his cat when it was being attacked or mauled,
right,
by the dog. So he was really, really caught up, which is really what happens to us. I mean, we're so caught up that if we're not in the now, then we miss and we can not hear things that are going on or around us.
That's exactly right. And if you are caught up in the thoughts of the past, then you don't often know the difference between, you know, what's present and what's past. You're actually kind of reliving those events, and then, of course, they engender fears for what's going to happen in the next day or two, or week or two, or whenever. And as Eckhart says, it robs you of your peace,
mm-hmm,
robs you of your joy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then he had this dream, and in the dream he was obviously running from Carter, who was his bully, and then almost running into his cat Snuggles bully, and then enters into a new place, which teaches him a little bit about the inside of now, which is about our feelings and how to feel, how to connect with the part of us that's inside instead of how we usually spend most of our time looking outside.
Yeah, that's the presence part that Eckhart writes about it. And of course, the metaphor in the book is light. That's a little ball of light that in his dream, he dreams that he's running and he goes into what's really the ice cream shop where he and his father used, and his grandfather would go to get ice cream, which was one of his favorite activities. the ice cream lady was in his dream, and she's the one who shows him the inside of the now, which is that, you know, we're all light, we're all part of God, we're all part of a greater consciousness and a greater thing, and we're just not ourselves, we're all one. And she shows him that with the light. And that, and that's the lesson that he learns about, you know, when he sees Carter again, he's able to control his fear reaction, because he realizes that, you know, he's part of this, this light is inside of him, it's inside of Carter, it's inside of everyone. And for, you know, a boy of that age, that's a pretty interesting lesson.
Be pretty amazing.
Yeah. We're hoping that the youngsters who get that, you know, will get that, because that's not going to be as easy to access, I think, as the outside of the now.
Right.
But I think, well, I can't, I'm not going to say anymore, because they got to buy the book. You know?
Exactly.
They got to read this thing.
Well, it's a brilliant book to read, so I'm sure there'll be many Christmas gifts this year that have that book in it, because it's a great book to read.
Thanks.
So why a secret? Why is it Milton's secret? Why does it end saying, you know, we should keep it a secret?
Well, that's kind of, it's not, you know, the secret is in the book. It's not that we're keeping the thing a secret.
True.
From the reader. But Milton just says, you know, at the end he's talking to his grandfather, and he tells him that he learned about the inside of the now, and his grandfather says, well, tell me about it. And he says, I can't, it's a secret. But I think he will, you know, in the next book, he'll tell his grandfather what he learned. Got to keep it going, you know. Keep the story going.
Well, there you go. See, I would never be able
but
to.
But I think, you know, anybody who reads the book can see what the secret is.
Oh, absolutely.
But I always joke with people. They say, well, why aren't you telling the secret? I say, well, you got to buy the book. You know?
Uh-huh. Do you think that we all need to sort of, I guess, sit with it within ourselves for a while before we, you know, can try and explain it to others? I mean, is that part of the reason? Because, I mean, it's sort of talked in the book where the ice cream lady says, well, not a lot of people are going to understand it. But it's really, you know, you have to understand it in the beginning.
Well, it's true. I you know, it's a difficult concept for a lot of people, the same way that, you know, they couldn't get Neil's concept of God, because it goes against, you know, their beliefs or what they've been taught. It's very difficult to get beyond that. And it's the same thing with the ego. I mean, the ego is in such control of most people that they don't even know they're being controlled. They don't even know what the ego is.
Yeah.
They identify with that thought process that goes through their head, you know, 24 hours a day and never stops, you know, what Joyce called the stream of consciousness. They identify with that as themselves so much that they don't even realize that it's not themselves. You know, it's like they're asleep, and nobody's ever woken them up. So it's very difficult to cross that boundary and say, you know, that stuff that's going through your head, that's not you.
Yeah.
They don't even understand that, because the stuff that continues to go through their head is going to say, what? Are you crazy?
Yeah. I go through that with people that are on this path. And you try and point out when they're in their own drama, and you go, you do know that, you know, that's not you, right? Like, these are your past, and it's, you know, you're trying to explain to them, and they're looking at you like you're crazy, and yet they know this stuff.
Yeah.
But when it's your own thing, it's really hard to detach from it.
It's very difficult. Even, like you say, when you have an understanding of it, it's difficult because you almost have to be in that level of awareness all the time in order to catch it. Otherwise, you're going to react almost normally because you've lived almost all your life that way. And, you know, someone says something to you and you immediately react. And that's the ego reacting. It's not the higher self in most instances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the great masters have total control of that. And that's why they don't argue with you or judge you or you know, anything, or tell you what to do even, because that's ego. That comes from ego, and they're totally above that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it's very difficult to stay in that mode. From what I understand, Eckhart had, when he had that epiphany, he actually sat on a park bench for like 6 months and did nothing except observe nature and observe people. And he would talk to people, he'd interact with them, and they took care of him, and they'd feed him, and they'd take him home, and they, you know, somehow he survived 6 months on a park bench.
Yeah.
But he was totally in the now. He was totally in that zone where he didn't react to anything. He was just looking at a flower and saying, wow. Or a tree, or a little girl, or a blade of grass, or anything.
Yeah.
But then very gradually he kind of, you know, came out of that and, you know, kind of went back into what people would call normal life, and, you know, became a teacher and a spiritual advisor and counselor and a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But he could have very well stayed in that for the rest of his life, you know, and maybe just sat on the park bench for the next 30 years. I don't know if that's possible or not. But.
Yeah.
But I guess he had some things he had to do.
Definitely. So the fact that you're in the publishing business, how does that affect the way you've handled this book?
Well, it's kind of being on both sides of the fence at the same time. It's been very interesting.
I bet.
I don't really get involved in, you know, I don't go to my publicity person and say, you got to get this thing out there. I just let things take their course and keep an eye on, you know, ask questions and stuff. But, you know, I'm just going to let it go where it's going to go. And we've got good people who, you know, who sell and distribute and publicize, and we'll see. And hopefully Eckhart might get back on Oprah. Who knows?
Would you go with them?
Well, I don't know. If they invite me, I certainly will. But I'm not sure. I mean, he's the one who has the, you know, the reputation and the brand, as we call it in the business.
Yeah.
And I don't mind it. He takes all the credit, to tell you the truth.
You're a very humble person. I can tell that you're very gentle in the way you've delivered this interview, and it's been a very pleasurable talking with you.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation. Are we done?
We are. Would you like to tell people how they can get a hold of Milton's Secret and get a hold of your company?
Well, in Canada, it's pretty well everywhere. All the major stores, Chapters, and Amazon, and, you know, same in the United States, and Barnes & Noble, and Borders. And it's just about everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You can order it from our website, which is hrpub.com. But we prefer that you go to Amazon and places like that, because it helps get more books out there when they sell through the retailers.
Nice. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us before you go?
Not really. I think we've had a good conversation.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. And thanks for the opportunity to talk about Milton, and I hope people can, you know, go out and read it to their children. Or some people ask me, you know, what's the age level? I say 8 to 80. I think adults and older people can get a lot out of this as well.
I agree. Well, I look forward to having you back when you write the next book.
Thank you. I'll let you know.
All right. Well, it's been a great pleasure, and I really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.